Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, the author of Weird Illinois gives us some ideas for unusual road trip destinations. We chat with the director of the film Chasing October about the Chicago Cubs' ill-fated 2003 season. We find out about the Art Theory Summer Camp, and we celebrate National Hot Dog Month. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. In downtown Champaign, every Thursday night this summer, a small group of people are meeting to unwind and to talk about art. They are part of the Art Theory Summer Camp, an open public discussion held at Open Source Art Space. Sidetrack's Matt Kessler has more.
When you think of summer camp, what is the first thing to come to mind? Bathing suits? S'mores? Archery? What about art theory? This year, Champaign's Open Source is offering a new type of summer camp, the Art Theory Summer Camp. A weekly public discussion of theoretical writings by critics such as Walter Benjamin and Michel Foucault. Each Thursday night at 7 p.m., all members of the community are invited to come and discuss pre-selected readings. Organized by graduate student Amber Ginsburg, this summer's focus is on the concept of the archive.
There are shorter articles based around the idea of the archive, either reviews of shows, general overview of theory, or more abstractly, just looking at the ideas of collecting.
To those unfamiliar with open source, the idea of weekly theoretical discussions about art theory might sound unusual, but an art theory summer camp is precisely the sort of event that open source was created to host. Open source refuses to call itself an art gallery because, in addition to art exhibits, it also hosts such varied activities as belly dancing classes, clothing exchanges, and a weekly workshop to make home products out of recycled materials. It is a community-run art space with no president or owner and no profit scale. If you have an idea of how to use the space, come to one of the biweekly meetings and make a proposal. If the members like the idea, the event might take place in a matter of weeks. Likewise, if you'd like to be a member of the governing body, simply start attending the meetings.
Open source is an alternative art space that exists primarily as an idea. We also have a space that we work in, but it's really an idea that functions from the groups of people that's involved.
Most of the members of open source have strong opinions, and every project proposal is analyzed with a fine comb. All aspects of a proposal are open for debate, including start times, activity timetables, membership fees, and names included on email lists. Nothing can happen without group consensus. In this environment, where dialogue rules, it is no surprise that an art theory summer camp is thought of as the perfect recreational activity for the summer.
Art theory summer camp is an opportunity to read theory as a group and use sort of questions and answers as a group to sort of figure out what these writings mean.
So what does a meeting consist of? The inaugural meeting was 3 weeks ago and it took place in a small room. 10 people were sitting in a circle. Some were middle-aged parents and some were young undergrads. The topic at hand was the notion of the archive. The following questions were asked to frame the discussion. Does an archive enable or limit the freedom of artistic dialogue? Can a piece of art be pertinent if it has been archived? Can it be permanently experienced if it has not? Someone read the following quote from the essay Drama in the Archive by Rebecca Comey. The archive presents itself as the ultimate horizon of experience. From this, the definition of the word horizon was discussed. If a horizon is the demarcation between foreground and background, one participant asked, does the archive operate accordingly? And so went the discussion. All remarks were springboards for new remarks. All disagreements led to new questions. Most importantly, all opinions were respected and all were encouraged to participate. At the meeting's end, participants were told to bring new friends.
I think that for whatever reason, perhaps the vocabulary or perhaps just the idea of theory, people tend to be kind of intimidated, I think, by art theory. And I really love it. It has this very odd mixture of the grandiose and the poetic. And it talks about horizons and then the deeply specific use of language. And a very specific, it goes from the miniature and the gigantic very quickly in mini paragraphs. So I really like it, but that doesn't mean I necessarily understand it, or each time I read it, I understand it very differently.
There's no price to be placed on the value of dialogue. Unfortunately, there's no price to pay to attend these meetings. Art Theory Summer Camp has only just begun, and everyone in the community is invited to attend.
Sidetrack's Matt Kessler. Open Source Art Space is located at 12 East Washington in Champaign. Art Theory Summer Camp meets every Thursday night at 7 p.m. All are invited. This is Sidetrack. Earlier this week, during the annual Nathan's Famous 4th of July hot dog eating contest, American Joey Chestnut downed a gut-busting 63 hot dogs in 12 minutes, a new record. Summers just wouldn't be summers without this contest and without the joys of hot dogs. In fact, July has been declared National Hot Dog Month. I recently talked with Patrick Wilson, Public Affairs Manager, from the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council about this all-American food.
It's a big month for us. It's sort of our biggest month because not only do we have National Hot Dog Month, but we also have National Hot Dog Day, which is July 18th this year. And we also have the 4th of July, which is probably the biggest hot dog holiday of them all. So, we get ready just by, we do a lot of interviews and whatnot, but, we just do whatever we can to make sure that hot dogs are on the top of everyone's mind. We also host a luncheon up on Capitol Hill. We're in Washington. We host a luncheon on the Hill for, senators and representatives to come and eat a dog and talk about hot dogs and everything and meet some all-star baseball players from years past. So it's a fun time for us. It's an exciting time and a busy time.
So how did National Hot Dog Month and I guess National Hot Dog Day come about?
We're actually in our 50th year this year of National Hot Dog Month. We go all the way back to 57. So, and I unfortunately was not around for that. So I'm not quite sure, but, I think it just sort of came about and the likeness that all those other, national this days or national this months and whatnot. It's sort of a honorary thing. It's a promotional thing. And it's just, time to celebrate something that is American.
Now, there's always been some debate about how the hot dog got its name. Can you enlighten us a little bit?
It's funny because I think that's one of those things that it's just like America's never going to know, kind of right up there with, where Hoff is buried. But, hot dogs, the main rumor that goes around is that a sportscaster or a cartoonist originally placed the hot dog name on it. Supposedly somebody couldn't pronounce dachshund dogs, or they couldn't spell dachshund dogs, which is what hot dogs were sort of referred to in the early part of the 1900s. And so instead of writing dachshund, they wrote hot, or they said hot, and then that sort of stuck as hot dogs. The other sort of rumor is that it was at a baseball game, a cold, dreary day, and people were not satisfied with their popcorn and pretzels. And so a vendor went out and raided a hot dog cart across the street and came back. And in order to help promote the dogs, they were yelling out hot dogs as a warm something to eat on a cold day. So, I don't know which of those stories is the most true or or whatnot. And I think it's just going to be one of those things that lives in mystery forever.
Now, I grew up near Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and that is a town that takes its hot dog eating very seriously.
But they certainly do.
But according to your website, Chicago was fifth in 2006 when it came to hot dog consumption.
Well, that is hot dog sales at retail stores. So perhaps more Chicagoans are actually buying their dogs on the street, which obviously becomes a very difficult thing to track since hot dogs don't have barcode scanners on them. But yeah, in terms of actual hot dog sales at grocery stores, yeah, Chicago is not at the top of the list. So Chicagoans are going to have to go out to their grocery stores and stock up this week.
But I'm so surprised because the Chicago dog in and of itself is a work of art.
It is, and it is, I think, one of the more well-known in terms of specific toppings. I think it sort of boils usually down to New York versus Chicago in terms of who has the better hot dog toppings. And we have a Chicagoan here on staff at the Hot Dog Council, and she'll definitely go to bat for the toppings there on the Chicago dog, which is more than I think I could probably fit in my mouth.
Well, here's a debate I have with people all the time when it comes to the subject of hot dogs, and it boils down to this. Ketchup has no place on a hot dog. What's the official stance of the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council on that?
The official stance we have, which is part of our hot dog etiquette, actually, is that ketchup does not belong on a hot dog unless if you're past the age of 18. Ketchup is kid stuff and should remain there. Although it's a big debate, even here in our office, I think we're 2-1 right now in terms of mustard versus ketchup. But I don't think ketchup has any place on a hot dog either.
Well, I did look at this hot dog etiquette page on your website. Tell us a little bit more about the do's and don'ts of hot dog eating.
Well, the hot dog etiquette is a sort of tongue-in-cheek thing we did a few years back, and it's all about keeping the hot dog fun and casual, which is exactly what a hot dog is. So, top of the list is, of course, the ketchup issue, but, you go on down and, some things like you never need to use cloth, napkins or tablecloths with it. You know, no silverware, paper plates and paper towels are best. Try to eat your hot dog in 5 bites. Lick the, if you have any mustard or anything on your hand afterwards, use your tongue instead of a, napkin or whatever. So it's kind of a fun, it's just all about keeping hot dogs casual because they're not a stuffy thing to be eating.
So this recent 4th of July, they had the big hot dog eating contest on Coney Island like they do every year. How does the council feel about this contest and the competitive eating of hot dogs?
Well, we certainly think that, competitive eating is not something you need to try at home. We think you should enjoy your hot dogs, of course. But it's the Coney Island thing, and a lot of people have hot dog eating contests all over the country, and they're fun. They train for them. Those guys train for that stuff. And it's just a fun thing. It definitely gets us a lot of attention around the holiday and whatnot. So, don't try to eat 70-some hot dogs on your own just sitting at your dining room table.
Well,
moderation is the key.
Well, tell us a little bit about the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council. What's your guys' purpose?
Our main purpose is just to keep hot dogs in the front of everyone's mind as a delicious and wholesome American, sort of icon. And we celebrate National Hot Dog Month. We also celebrate National Sausage Month in October. As a small little informational and promotional organization dedicated to the hot dog.
What's the strangest thing you've heard of that people put on hot dogs?
I've heard of some pretty strange things. I think the strangest hot dog overall was we heard about last year is someone was trying to make a hot dog that had peanut butter in it. Not on it, but rather inside the emulsion they used to make the hot dog. It was like a peanut butter hot dog. So that's probably the oddest I think I've ever heard. I have heard of people also putting like peanut butter and jelly on the hot dog. And I think that's probably the weirdest and sort of the thing that sets my own stomach in a whirl.
Well, if people want to tell you about weird things they put on hot dogs or just learn about the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council, where should they go?
They can go to our website, which is www.hot-dog.org. And there's all sorts of fun facts and trivia. We've got some recipes up there for hot dogs and sausages, and just a ton of information about one of America's favorite foods.
That was Patrick Wilson, Public Affairs Manager for the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council, talking about July being National Hot Dog Month. Listening to Sidetrack. Back in 1934, a group of eight women in Milton, Massachusetts, gathered with a goal to create a uniquely tuneful pet canary for American homes. The result of their breeding experiments was the American Singer Canary, specially built to produce the sweetest song imaginable. Today, there are 41 chapters of the American Singer Club throughout the United States and Canada, many of which hold song trials to determine the breed's best avian soloists. One of the biggest competitions takes place each year in Livonia, Michigan, just outside Detroit. Producers Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister documented these recent song trials as hundreds of green, yellow, and variegated canaries assembled in identical cages in a church gymnasium, waiting in turn to battle it out.
Bird's ready. Bird's ready.
It's Saturday morning at the Dragon Song Trials. The judging is underway and will continue until at least 7 o'clock tonight.
I don't know.
Bird's coming through.
My name is Jessie Durkin, and I am the treasurer of the Dragon Chapter 22 of the American Singers Club. The Dragon Club stands for the determined renaissance of the American Singer Canary through growth and organization of the novice. We try to specifically tune for beginners, get out information, try to attract new fanciers.
Oh, and you have exact change. I love it.
Our show is pretty much typical. An entry fee would be $2 a bird.
Total birds in the show, 245. I personally brought 14, because that's the limit.
Mike Groman's my name. I'm from Saginaw, Michigan. I've been a member of the club since 1982. This is a big show. This show is probably the biggest in the nation. And I was lucky to win last year. In a way, I hope somebody else does it this year so they get the same excitement. I've enjoyed retirement. At one time, I was a woodcarver. I raised roses and I raised canaries. But first I cut the wood carving and then I slowed down on the roses. But I have to keep doing one thing. Three things were just too much. I duck hunt, and so I train mine up at the hunting camp. What you want is exposure to people. Move them around, getting used to touching the cage. And I play Mozart. They love Mozart. And I started out on Willie Nelson. That doesn't work. As much as I like Willie Nelson. This bird has a fault that every once in a while, it'll open its mouth and go, caw, caw. That's a fault, but it has freedom, which means it sings a lot. It has a lot of variety. You can breed that bird to another line that's quiet, and you'll breed out that. So the young will have that freedom, but it won't have that obnoxious note. Okay, we are now proceeding to judge 8 birds in the chapel that's been converted into a bird judging room, which consists of fluorescent lights about 4 foot over the birds with a white sheet backdrop so that you can see the bird's throat when they sing.
One bird per cage. They're set before the judge 8 feet away. He sits 8 feet away.
And in there we have to be quiet because he has to concentrate on the song, and any noise distracts him, and he'll look at you funny.
They're given a few minutes to settle down, and the first 10 minutes they're judged on freedom.
My name is Don Taylor. I'm an American Singer Club judge. Well, freedom, simply how much do they sing? And a score of 10 is they sing once every minute for 10 minutes, and that's the first part of the 20-minute judging session.
And then they have another 10 minutes, and that is rendition period, and that's judged on what they sing, quality of the song, the variety, the tone, the different number of songs. Some birds sing, 13, 14 different songs. And whether they'll sing them all in one day is depends on the bird.
Some of these birds, it's just like they create the song, but it's never the same. And they'll go slower and faster. And you can just tell they really enjoy singing and creating a musical masterpiece. The Mozarts and Beethoven and Chopins of the bird world. First place?
Well, he missed the fault. I heard it.
Number 9 all the way to the end? In second?
Had he heard it, it wouldn't have been first place.
The 5 there is in third place.
As I said, it has a great song and lots of freedom. And even if it stopped to eat, it shouldn't even do that. But he still liked it.
486. 483.
They'll get a first, second, third for every class of 8 birds.
484.
That doesn't mean they're the best in show. That means they were just the best in that group. And then at the end of the day, when we've transferred all the scores, we pick the best 10 in show.
My name is Mike Griffin. I've been a member for 3 years now. Cage 483 is my bird, and he needs 4 more points to be a grand champion. And he doesn't even need to be best in show to get his grand championship. He just needs to be number 3, 2, or 1. And that's all I'm looking for.
A grand champion is a bird who accumulates 20 points. So our show, the top bird will win 6 points. And 5, 4, 3, 2 is for the top 6 places. And there's no set time limit on it. You can show a bird that's 4 years old and still develop a grand champion. But he has to have 1 first place win, and he has to accumulate a total of 20 points. And then it's a grand champion.
Time for the next class.
Now, occasionally you get a really loud bird and you cover them up so they'll stop singing. So you have some white cloth that you put over an individual cage if there's a really screecher bird that it's just annoying you. But then you can concentrate on maybe a quieter bird.
I needed a placing in this class to become a grand champion. When the judge covered up that bird, I was absolutely shocked and devastated. That bird was doing nothing but what he does. And he's 3 times best in show, and he picked a bird that's never placed at all. And to cover up a bird like that, I'm just shocked by that.
A lackluster class.
Yeah, a lackluster class. Well, then I'll have to say that's a lackluster judge.
We're trying to do the best job for these birds, and we're trying to pick out the best one for today. And if your bird's too loud, well, please. You just need to breed some quieter birds.
Ten minutes to 9, the judging is all over.
Now comes the fun part, giving out the awards. It's what everybody waits for. sort of like the Oscars, and the winner is.
And the best bird in show was Cage 211 with a score of 91.5, and he is bred by Roger Strowman.
Well, there's always a next show, so keep you coming back, I guess. Can't win them all.
I have no complaints. The fault bird that has the funny... when it did it the only one time during the show, and the judge had his head down. So it placed ninth in the show, which is pretty spectacular, because that's out of 245 birds.
And it's now 10 minutes to 10, and it's all over, and you can kind of hear in the background people are packing up their birds, and all the scores will be recorded, and we pack up and go home and do it all again next year. And we all have to vacuum up all the bird seed that everybody has left behind. So if you're feeling generous, grab a vacuum.
And the songbirds keep singing like they know the score. And I love you, I love you, I love you like never before. And I love you, I love you, I love you like never before.
That story was produced by Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister for Long Haul Productions. To come on the program, ideas for out-of-the-way summer travel locations from the author of Weird Illinois and the man behind the film Chasing October about the Chicago Cubs' heartbreaking 2003 season. Stay tuned. You've got attuned to Sidetrack. If you're looking to do some summer traveling and are tired of the same old tourist locations, Troy Taylor, author of Weird Illinois, has a few out-of-the-ordinary suggestions for you. Now, regular listeners of the program will know Taylor as our resident ghost hunter, who we talk to periodically during Halloween season. I spoke with him earlier this week about weird places in Illinois to visit.
You and I have talked quite a few times before, Jason, so you know that I know Illinois stuff. And Illinois, I'm born and raised here, and, you know, I've lived here my whole life, and I've always been interested in the unusual, from ghost stuff to, you know, Bigfoot sightings to you name it. I've been interested in it when it comes to Illinois. So really the book was pretty simple for me to put together. And a lot of stuff that I had before, and it gave me a chance, really, though, because this book is, if you're familiar with the book at all, it's very heavily illustrated. It's very photograph-oriented. So it gave me a chance to actually travel all over the state to a lot of places I'd been to before, you know, but then a lot of places that were new to me. And that, I think, was the really amazing thing, was the traveling around, you know, taking photographs of, you know, going to Griggsville and taking photographs of these gigantic birdhouses where, you know, where the purple martins come, or, you know, going to Amboy and taking photographs of this giant giant totem pole, or down to Gays, Illinois to see the two-story outhouse that I'd only heard about, you know. So I got a chance to see all this stuff firsthand, and that, for that reason, the book has become like a guidebook for people who are, you know, on vacation, or, you know, these days, I mean, lately, in the last year or so, a lot of people don't want to take a vacation, you know, all the way to the Grand Canyon, you know, because nobody wants to pay for the gas. So people are looking for something fun or something cool to do on a weekend. And the book has become like a guidebook for these people. I mean, you wouldn't believe the emails and the phone calls and stuff I get from people who are like, yeah, man, I never knew, you know, we had all this stuff. I just never knew any of it was here. And that's exactly how I felt when I, you know, went out looking for this stuff. You know, I would go to places, and I remember going to this town, and I was looking for, somebody had given me a lead for a giant chair. I know this sounds really bizarre, but it was supposed to be this giant chair that some guy had put together using, like, you know, pieces of trees or something. It was supposed to be like 40 feet tall or something. And so I'm off looking for this chair, and it's a little town, and I'm thinking, you know, I mean, how hard can it be to find a 40-foot chair in this town? So I'm driving around and, you know, looking for this chair, and I'm not finding it. And I drove everywhere I could possibly think of. So I finally pull into this, to a gas station, this little convenience store, and I went in and I said, and you wouldn't believe how many times I said something like this. I have a really weird question to ask you. and the guy behind the counter said, yeah. And I said, well, I'm looking for this giant chair that's supposed to be here in town. And he's like, a giant chair? And I said, yeah, it's some guy's supposed to have made it out of, you know, out of trees. And he goes, man, I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about, and I've lived here forever. And I thought, oh boy, well, that's not a good lead. And he said, and so, I mean, you know, I had driven like an hour out of my way to find this chair. And he says, but if you go down to the park, there's this really weird, there's these really weird carvings in the park. You just got to go take a look. So I drove down to the city park, which is like on the edge of town. And I'm driving around through the park, and there are these statues that someone has carved out of, like, I don't know, like tree stumps. And they're lurking in the park. Now, I don't mean they're just, like, out on display. I mean, they're, like, hiding behind trees and very, very weird. So, needless to say, that went into the book. It was something new, something that I had not had in the book before. So, you know, I was very excited about that. You know, and that was the thing about the book, was finding these new things in new places and you know, just odd things. And it was just a thing that people have gotten very excited about, the chance to go see this stuff.
Now, for those of us who are taking those small summer vacations, like you mentioned, and maybe don't have any experience with this sort of strange side of Illinois attractions, what are some good sort of starting points, starting attractions, places that people can go that are, you know, pretty well known, pretty, you know, not as hidden as those tree statues, but, you know, pretty easy to find, but have that weird punch to them?
Well, I mean, you can start pretty easy. You can make it a theme. I found in certain sections when I was working on the book, I would actually do it as sort of a theme. I would look for instance, you can do Lincoln stuff. And by Lincoln stuff, I mean, you don't have to go to, you know, Lincoln's home or the Presidential Museum. I mean, all that stuff is great, but not necessarily weird. When you want to get into weird, you go find the weird Lincoln stuff, the weird Lincoln statues. Like there's a giant, very angry Abraham Lincoln near Charleston at a campground outside of town. The campground, last time I was there, was closed, but you can still see the Lincoln statue, and he's holding a very big axe. And all you can think of when you see this is, let's not make the president angry, because he's very, very scary looking. There's also, right off Interstate 55, just south of Springfield, there is an Abraham Lincoln who is driving a covered wagon and reading a book. I don't know why, but it's a giant Abraham Lincoln statue who's doing this, or figure. The other Lincoln one that I always find entertaining is the one in Lincoln, Illinois. This is probably the weirdest Lincoln monument, I think, probably anywhere in the country. All it is a statue of a watermelon with a bite out of it. The story is that Abraham Lincoln christened the town of Lincoln, which was named in his honor, of course, by spitting watermelon juice on the ground. That was how he christened it. His thing was that, and this is a quote, that nothing named Lincoln ever amounted to anything. So he really didn't think much of the town being named in his honor. I mean, he was just an attorney at the time, but he had, you know, helped them get the town started, and so they named it after him, which, of course, they didn't know at the time what, you know, fame he would go on to reach, but I don't think he was too impressed with the idea. So you could take a weird Lincoln trip around. You could also do a trip that is, I guess the best way to describe it would be just weird figures. In the book, I call them roadside oddities. I mean, that's what we've always called them as far as the weird series has gone. And these are giant, again, kind of statues in a way, but they're, it's kind of hard to describe because they're not really statues. They're made out of fiberglass, and they occasionally you'll see them in different places. Springfield, for instance, has a great one that everybody's really familiar with over there. It's the Lauterbach Tire Man. He is a giant lumberjack who stands outside of a tire store. And I know it doesn't really make any sense when you think lumberjack, tire store, how does that go together? But a lot of these fiberglass statues like this were put to secondary use. Originally, he stood outside of a pancake place, and he had a big axe. He was supposed to be like Paul Bunyan. Well, the pancake place closed. The tire manor, as he became known, was picked up by another company, and he was changed and adapted and became holding. Now he holds a flag and a tire out in front of the store. What was interesting about the Lauterbach Tire Man is, if you remember last year when they had the tornadoes in Springfield, the Lauterbach Tire Man completely lost his head, flew off in the tornado. And there was a great photograph that ran in the newspaper of a guy walking across the field carrying the tire man's head back to the tire place where they did reattach, and he's in good shape now. But you could actually take a tour around. Believe it or not, there are more of these things left. Now, a lot of them just disappeared over the years. They got trashed. They, you know, were outside of hot dog places and pancake houses and stuff, and they just sort of disappeared as time marched on, because a lot of them really seemed to be centered on Route 66. And it was that time period, that 40s and 50s time period, where a lot of these things popped up. If you go down to southern Illinois, there's a grocery chain called Big John's. Big John Groceries is it's a small chain. There's about three or four of them in southern Illinois. All of them have a giant grocery man outside, and he is one of these weird statues carrying a couple of bags of groceries. Interestingly, there is a Big John grocery man in the town of Metropolis, where the giant Superman statue is, which is the similar type of statue as to what I'm talking about. If you're familiar with the Superman statue, we've always, you know, guessed that the Metropolis Big John Man is actually Clark Kent in disguise, and in the daytime he actually just carries groceries, and so he's Superman at night. But you'll find those guys scattered around. They are, you know, there's a couple of them. I mean, you can really find some great ones. There's a little town called Atlanta right off of Interstate 55, used to be right on Route 66. And Atlanta is, I mean, this is just tiny little town, but it's definitely worth the trip. They've really done a great job. They've tried to restore their downtown as to how it looked like in the 50s. But what they've done is they've actually picked up a couple of these statues. The hot dog man is the most famous one. It's a guy stands right on Main Street in Atlanta carrying or holding a giant hot dog. And he was actually rescued from a hot dog place that went out of business in Chicago and somehow ended up in Atlanta. And they've really done a cool job of fixing him up. My favorite one of these statues, though, is up in Wilmington, which is, again, right on Old Route 66, heading up towards Chicago. It's south of Chicago, maybe 50 miles, maybe 40 miles. And there's a diner in Wilmington, and it's called the Launching Pad Restaurant, and they named it because of the giant who stands outside. It's the home of the Gemini Giant, and he's a spaceman. Again, from the 50s, again, one of these fiberglass statues, but he's got a big space helmet on his head, and he's holding a rocket ship. And that's probably my favorite one of all of these statues that are scattered around the state. But, I mean, you can make it, you know, you can make it a theme. There's more of them around. I mean, there's so much of this odd stuff to see from the, you know, the giant ketchup bottle down in Collinsville, you know, all the Lincoln stuff. You can go down to Chester, see the Popeye statue. And you know what's amazing is the other things that you'll find while you're doing this and while you're traveling around seeing these different things. I went up to there's a town called Oregon, which is out kind of north, a little northwest of Chicago, on the Fox River, and I was looking for this giant Chief Blackhawk statue. And, you know, all I knew that it was there was this big statue out there. And I thought, well, I'll go, you know, go take a picture of it. When I got out there to the area, I found what a fabulous and what a fantastic, beautiful area it was. And, you know, I honestly had no idea. And I think that's the thing to keep in mind while you're out traveling around, while you're out doing this stuff. You know, there's so much here in Illinois that people just have no idea is there, and that, I think, is really the key thing to keep in mind when you're doing this.
That was Troy Taylor, author of Weird Illinois. He'll be doing a talk in Champaign later this month about places described in his book. He's scheduled to be at the Champaign Public Library on Tuesday, July 17th at 7 p.m. You're listening to Sidetrack. As a narrator remarks before the opening credits of the film Chasing October, being a Cubs fan isn't easy. In what he calls a docu-comedy, writer-director Matt Liston chronicles the 2003 campaign from spring training straight through the infamous Steve Bartman play and the Cubs' eventual collapse to the Florida Marlins. Liston's efforts to will his team to the 2003 World Series is now on DVD. Resident diehard Cubs fan Jeff Bossert spoke with Liston about introducing his movie to a new audience.
Chasing October, A Fan's Crusade, is a labor of love for Matt Liston, who grew up in Chicago's south suburbs. A former crew member on TV shows like Friends and Seinfeld, Liston worked his sense of humor, seemingly a necessity for Cub fans, into the plot of his film.
This was going to be the year that the Cubs finally win the World Series, which they haven't done since 1908. I mean, since then, we've had 16 presidents. 5 states have come into the Union. Radio and TV have been invented. Now we can fly. Man has landed on the moon. Let me put it to you this way. The Titanic was built, sank, lost, found, and then made into a crappy movie, all since the Cubs last won the World Series. So it was clear to me, my mission was to follow the Cubs' journey to the World Series and to film the whole thing.
There is a writing credit from you and your colleague. I mean, it has a script. But how much of this was just a stroke of luck that the Cubs obviously didn't finish the way we wanted it to, but we got into the playoffs and still had a great season?
Yeah, we were very fortunate. We were very fortunate in terms of the film. I mean, of all seasons, you know, to pick in the past, you know, 20-some years, we were very fortunate to get that 2003 season. And, you know, because, first of all, people, when they think of 2003, they go right to the Bartman play. And as painful as that was, I was thankful that we had the cameras rolling at that moment, because it makes for a significant, it's a significant moment in our film and in Cubs history, so it's great to have captured it. However, that being said, you know, there was a lot of great moments in 2003, and I think that those get overshadowed a lot by the Bartman play and by Game 6 and 7, which is unfortunate, because 2003 was a magical season. I mean, if you talk to old Cub fans, a lot of them talk about 69. Well, they never got to the postseason. A lot of Cub fans will talk about 84. Now, when they talk about 84, they usually talk about it and celebrate 1984. They don't talk so much about the loss to the Padres as they do Ryne Sandberg's 2-home run game against St. Louis on June 23rd, you know. But yet, if you bring up 2003, people jump right to Game 6 and 7. And what I like about our film is you kind of see the ride. You know, you see it from spring training. You see Dusty come to town. You see, you know, us pull off the trade for Kenny Lofton and the energy he brought to the field. You see the excitement of Sammy Sosa and Moises Alou and Carlos Zambrano. You know, and I like that because that we should celebrate 2003. As painful as it was, it's part of our past, and it was a great season.
You've had some screenings. You had some in the Chicago area, and I know some around, I think, on the West Coast.
We've had screenings in Los Angeles, the Phoenix area. Let's see, this film played in Indianapolis, and then, you know, quite a few theaters in the Chicagoland area. And it got a great response. We were very, very, very pleased with how it did at the box office. But I got to tell you, I'm most excited about this whole DVD. I mean, the DVD is an exciting world to be in at this point in time. I mean, just in the industry, I mean, DVD is just as important as your box office, if not more important. But for me, the reason I'm excited that it's out on DVD is essentially, you know, more people will get to see the film now. And not only will they get to see the film, but as you know, Jeff, it's loaded with bonus features. So, you know, a lot of the scenes that didn't make the film have found new life with the DVD.
Well, something that stands out for me is when you got to talk to Ryne Sandberg in his house.
I've got to tell you, that for me is probably my favorite scene in the outtakes because, well, first of all, the highlight perhaps of the whole project was getting to go to Ryne Sandberg's home. You know, he was my baseball hero growing up, and he opened up his home to me and to Chris for a day, and it was just amazing to go through, you know, his trophies. He was showing me his gold gloves, his silver slugger awards, you know, the ball that he got his first base hit with. And that was just amazing. But then when he stopped and shows us his framed letter, you know, it's a quite lengthy handwritten letter that from Harry Carey when Rhino was retiring. And you could see how much it meant to Ryne Sandberg. And it always killed me that I didn't have that in the film. And as you know, part of the storyline is, you know, the ghost of Harry Carey comes to me. So there was already a natural tie-in. But we just couldn't fit that in the movie and keep it moving forward. So I'm thrilled that it's on the DVD for true Cub fans to see.
3-2 pitch. Sosa not going. And it's in the air, short left field. It will fall in front of Chipper Jones. scoring is Kenny Watson and Chicago on the board.
I was in Atlanta to see them win that division series. I was at that game, but as much fun as it was being there, there's something about the scene of you and your friends at Murphy's Bleachers celebrating with a whole bar full of Cub fans. Because as much as I loved being there when it happened, and I'll always take that with me, there's something about being in Wrigleyville when you win the first postseason series since 1908.
Jeff, first of all, I'm thrilled you got to be there because, you know, I would have loved to have been in Atlanta. However, I feel like we couldn't make the trip, and we said in the film, at least I think it's in the film, unless we cut the line, if we couldn't be there, the next best place to be would be Murphy's Bleachers. However, I think fate was very kind to us because, just as you said, there's no other place I'd rather be than Murphy's Bleachers when the Cubs clinched because, you know, first of all, we throw a shot of Murphy's Bleachers in from the 1984 season. You know, we show a shot when the Cubs won in 1984, when they beat the Pittsburgh Pirates to clinch. That's in there briefly in the very beginning of the film. So it's really fun to go back 19 years later and kind of show the same image of the Cubs winning in 2003.
You've waited 95 years, Chicago. It's time to celebrate.
You know, here you are, you know, in Wrigleyville, literally feet away from Wrigley Field. And that celebration at Murphy's is something I'll always cherish. It could be nothing better. Standing on the bar, spraying the champagne. And for seasons since, if you look up at the ceiling, you can still see where some of that champagne stained the ceiling. So it's pretty special.
What else wasn't scripted? I mean, I'm not going to get into fine details, but what else outside of the ballpark really just came across as a stroke of luck in terms of conversations with fans, maybe? I don't know if maybe...
Well, I mean, I think the biggest thing is you see it in the film, and it's sincere when you see I'm talking to fans in the beginning of the season, and people laugh at me when I talk about the Cubs and World Series, and we're going to win this World Series. And people just thought I was crazy. I mean, that is true. And what's so interesting is towards the end of the season, in the second half, is when they're no longer laughing. They're high-fiving, and they're saying, we're going to do it. This is going to be the year. There's no other season that captured that, you know, in my lifetime quite as 2003 did. And so that was fun to capture that on tape. I mean, you know, it's interesting. If we needed a, like, let's say in the editing process, if we needed a bite where somebody was negative, we know to go to the front end of the tapes because the fans were negative. If we wanted a celebratory feel, well, we go towards the more current tapes. And it was really fun to capture that. I mean, the interesting thing, too, is since that time, you know, I think we caught on tape the last high of the highs, meaning, you know, we capture halfway through game six, you know, we think we're five outs away. So we went from, in the film, and what is true, in 2003, people were laughing about the Cubs going to a World Series. We followed that all the way up till 2003, where we're five outs away from actually going to a World Series, and that's pretty special. And the fact is, I don't think there's been that type of optimism since. You know, I think fans have had a really hard time believing, you know, in 2004, 2005, 2006, here we are in 2007. Thank goodness they're putting a little streak together, but it still pales in comparison to the high of highs, which was, 2003.
I would assume you've been able to keep up maybe with some players when you make your way back to Wrigley.
Sure. Well, I mean, I see the Cubs quite a bit, even though I'm living in Los Angeles right now. When they make their West Coast swing, I go to all those games, and I go to Chicago. I'm in Chicago at least once a month anyway. But I'm seeing Cub games all the time. I'm pretty good friends with some members of the team, and I think they've enjoyed the film and got a kick out of it. And a lot of the players on this 2007 team have told me that it's actually pumped them up. for the season, and that they know what a, you know, because most of the current team, the current roster, was not on that 2003 team. There's just a handful, not even a handful. There's Carlo Zambrano, an injured Kerry Wood, and, well, that's about it. So a lot of these players, like the Rich Hills and Derek Lee, you know, they've told me, you know, how it, they can see what it would be like, and they want to be a part of that. So, you know, I'm hoping our film helps out in a way. I mean, we have gotten every player on that 2007 roster has a copy of Chasing October, and we hope it can help, even if it's just in a little way, to inspire them.
Any future Cub projects for you sometime down the line?
We're always going to continue, you know, in some capacity, doing the what I call the Chasing October crusade. We've got a couple little things that we're working on right now that we will possibly use in a future project. But right now, what I'm really enjoying is the interaction I have with the fans, especially that now that Chasing October is getting seen by more and more people. The countless flow of emails we've received from folks has been awesome. It's so much fun to hear from Cub fans and get to meet all these true blue diehards. And, you know, even going around Wrigley Field, sharing some beers with some new friends because of the project has been a great experience, and that I want to continue to do.
Go Cubbies!
Go Cubbies!
Go Cubbies!
I believe in wishing well.
Just believe this year they're gonna do it when it's Christmas. I believe in Santa Claus.
Why do I believe? I guess that I believe because
Jeff Bosser talked with filmmaker Matt Liston, the writer, director, and executive producer of Chasing October, A Fan's Crusade. The film was recently released on DVD. For more information, check out CubsMovie.com. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.